Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Telephone Education Workshop, Hodgkin Lymphoma, Understanding Biology, Treatment, and Survivorship. This is a program that we have wanted to do for many, many years, and I really want to thank the Lymphoma Research Foundation for making this possible. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care, the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and 20 other cancer organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach over 724 participants on the program today. And you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Australia, Canada, Spain, Syria, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. I'd like to turn your attention to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers will be following, and there's information about the speakers. There also is information about all of the different organizations that have collaborated to make the program possible as resources for you to use. Also, there is an evaluation form. And if you would take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can really best tell us the type of programming that you would like us to do, the topics, the focus of the programs? Your input is invaluable to us. Indeed, our ability to offer this program was a testament to many of you requesting this topic over a long period of time and are finally being able to offer it. So please do tell us what you want, and we will very much try to provide that, that program for you. Now, today's project is supported through Cooperative Agreement number 1U58DP001110 from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Its content is solely the responsibility of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We are very indebted to the Lymphoma Research Foundation as well as the CDC for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. Joseph Connors. And Dr. Connors is clinical professor, University of British Columbia, chair of Lymphoma Tumor Group, British Columbia Cancer Agency. Dr. Connors is going to cover the biology of Hodgkin lymphoma and treatment options for newly diagnosed patients. I now want to turn this program over to Dr. Connors.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure and the privilege to be able to join you today. I'm going to talk about why or how this particular disease, Hodgkin lymphoma, develops and address some of the issues around the treatment of patients who have been found to have it. Each of us in our body has circulating white blood cells that moves around the body, and their purpose is to help us fight off virus infections. In order to do that properly, they have to develop usually antibodies that stick to the virus and neutralize it. So these cells are ones that the body has to manufacture on demand, keep for a while, and then get rid of. What goes wrong in a disease like Hodgkin lymphoma is that one of these cells comes into being in the body and goes through its initial normal processing, but then at the end of its ordinary life, it doesn't die off the way it's supposed to, but it sticks around. And having done that, having stayed in the body, it gives rise to copies of itself, which in turn stay around, and so these copies gradually increase in numbers. Now, ordinarily, this kind of a cell might stay there and not do very much, but in the case of Hodgkin lymphoma, in some cases, the cell continues to do some of its normal things, such as release chemicals into the bloodstream that can cause reactions in other parts of the body, like fevers or night sweats. And so these cells have two things wrong with them. One, they stay around when they're supposed to be gotten rid of, and the other, they can stir up reactions in the body due to their presence. in the case of Hodgkin lymphoma, not very many of these cells have to accumulate because the chemicals they release can cause other normal cells to gather in the same region of the body, and that place where the abnormal cells and the normal cells gather, those are typically in normal lymph nodes, gland-type structures along the side of our neck and down the center part of our body. These unwanted cells and the cells they attract can build up in those places and cause lumps. And these lumps are the things that typically people notice to tell that they have Hodgkin lymphoma. When those are biopsied and we determine that the disease is there, we're confident of what it is. This is somewhat similar to other diseases called non-Hodgkin lymphomas, but the big difference is the way in which the abnormal cells attract many other normal cells to form the lumps, or what doctors refer to as tumors. So the basic biology is that these cells come to the end of a normal lifespan, don't die, but rather stick around and sometimes stir up a lot of reaction in other parts of the body. That leads me right straight into the idea of treatment, that is, how one should or can try to get rid of these cells. And the two fundamental ideas about treatment are that we would do something, that is, we, the doctors, would do something that causes an injury to these unwanted cells. And that can tip them over into the normal process where they cause themselves to die. Normal cells do that regularly in a programmed way. These cells are abnormal and are refusing to do it, but exposure to drugs or radiation can cause the balance to tip and for those cells to die. So the two major tools that we use are chemotherapy, chemicals that are put into the body either as injections or pills, or radiation treatment, a beam of energy that's passed through a portion of the body that injures the cells in its path. The difficulty with these kinds of treatments is that they not only injure the abnormal cells that we want to get rid of, the Hodgkin lymphoma cells, but they also cause some injury to the normal cells of the body. So the doctors that are using these treatment techniques need to very carefully balance the effect such that we give enough of the chemicals, the chemotherapy, or enough of the radiation to injure the unwanted Hodgkin cells and get rid of them, but not so much that we cause major injury to the normal cells. When doctors think about treating an individual patient with Hodgkin lymphoma and are trying to figure out the best combination of the chemotherapy programs that are available and radiation treatment, we divide them up, the patients that is, we divide them into those that appear to have all or most of their Hodgkin lymphoma in one region of the body, compared to others that have their Hodgkin lymphoma spread to many different areas of the body. And doctors use a system with numbers in it, with low numbers, stages 1 and 2, indicating that the Hodgkin lymphoma is just confined to a modest area of the body, and stages 3 and 4 to indicate that the disease has spread more widely within the body. With that division in mind, we separate patients into two groups and say that there are some patients who have apparently limited stage 1 or 2 type of disease, and there the emphasis is on keeping the treatment brief, but at the same time making sure that enough has been given to try to get rid of it. I think it's safe to say that in most of the Western world, especially North America today, the usual approach to patients with limited stage Hodgkin lymphoma is to use a short course of chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is given as a series of either injections or pills that are repeated several times over, typically a couple of treatments per month for a few months of time. And then a plan is made to either shift over and add some radiation treatment or decide that the effectiveness of the chemotherapy that's been given so far is good enough that the program can finish with chemotherapy alone. And so a patient with limited stage, the small number stage 1 or 2 Hodgkin lymphoma, will typically receive a short course of chemotherapy, And along the way, depending upon what the tests have shown and how well the Hodgkin lymphoma is responding, their doctor will decide about whether radiation treatment should be added to that or not. When radiation is added, it is given to a small region of the body, the region that includes the abnormal lymph nodes where the disease was discovered in the first place, and is drawn by the radiation specialist so that it includes those abnormal lymph nodes and a small amount of normal tissue around them. And then daily, for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, a beam of radiation is passed through just that region of the body, injuring the cells in the path of the beam in such a way that the Hodgkin cells die off, but the normal cells recover and repair themselves. So a typical course of treatment for a patient with limited stage Hodgkin lymphoma would be a short run, 2 to 4 months of chemotherapy, followed by radiation treatment as the most usual course, and sometimes that radiation is dropped because the chemotherapy is succeeding so well, and it's going to be possible to successfully treat this with just the chemotherapy. Other patients present with Hodgkin lymphoma that has spread more widely in their body. It usually spreads from one lymph node site to another, and if it starts to be present in the top and bottom portions of the body, the upper and lower portions of the body, but still be in lymph nodes, doctors call that stage 3. If it jumps beyond the lymph node structures and gets into other structures in the body like the liver or the bone marrow or the lungs, doctors call that stage 4. In either case, because the Hodgkin lymphoma has spread around the body, the emphasis has to be on the chemotherapy because it can travel to all the places where these malignant cells might be hiding. And so doctors tend to choose a longer course of chemotherapy, perhaps as long as 6 to 8 months of repeated doses of the chemotherapy to treat advanced stage or stage 3 or stage 4 type Hodgkin lymphoma. Some cases, sometimes, the effectiveness of the chemotherapy is not quite as good as the doctors had planned for it to be, and even though patients have had that full 6 to 8 cycles of chemotherapy, it is thought best to add some additional radiation treatment at the end. But most patients with advanced stage, stage 3 or 4 Hodgkin lymphoma, are treated with chemotherapy alone. In particular cases where the original tumor, the place where the disease was first discovered, has grown particularly large, perhaps as large as a softball or slightly bigger, then that makes the likelihood that radiation will also be used quite a bit higher, and the person then receives the 6 to 8 months of chemotherapy followed by planned radiation. So those are the basic packages of treatment that we use. And with this approach, we injure the abnormal cells that we want the person to be rid of so that they die and are gone, but adjust things so that we don't injure the normal cells beyond their capacity to recover. And at the end of the treatment, a person can recover back to their normal self and in many cases have been rid of the Hodgkin lymphoma. Thank you.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Connors, for an excellent presentation, very understandable, very comprehensive, I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, but you've made the complex understandable, I think, for the audience, so thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Ana Funes, Director of Clinical Investigation and Translational Research, Professor of Medicine, Department of Lymphoma, Myeloma, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Funes is going to address treatment options for patients with relapsed or refractory disease, and he's also going to address quality of life concerns, including treatment, managing treatment side effects. Dr. Funes?
Yeah, thanks. And again, I appreciate this opportunity to participate in this conference. So the treatment that Dr. Connors talked about, treating patients with frontline therapies, cures the vast majority of patients. On the average, if you take 100 patients with newly diagnosed with Hodgkin lymphoma, you can cure these days about 80-85% of all patients. So we're talking about the small number of patients who are unfortunate to either not respond to their primary frontline therapy, or they may respond and achieve remission and then relapse after that. So at the present time, the standard of care for this patient population is to change the chemotherapy regimen to what we call second line or salvage regimen. And if we can achieve a second remission using this second line regimen, then the standard of care is to build on this success with what we call stem cell transplant. And if you do this as a package, if one can achieve a complete second complete remission, then go into transplant, the expectation is that we can cure approximately 50% of the patients. That means that a certain number of patients will have their disease come back after stem cell transplantation, which is more challenging than treating a newly diagnosed patient. As of today, there is no standard of care for patients whose disease relapse or doesn't respond to stem cell transplant. There are several treatment approaches for this patient population, ranging from different types of chemotherapeutic agents, either as single agents or in combination, or offering patients a novel investigational therapies. The options here can vary depending on the sites and centers and availability of these drugs and whether the patient can tolerate these treatments or not. But in general, if one uses combination chemotherapy after stem cell transplantation, the average duration of success or response is about 6 months or so. That's the average. Some patients have longer duration of response. Some patients have less. But if you use combination chemotherapy after relapse from autologous stem cell transplantation, that's what we expect. The other alternative approaches is to use novel investigational drugs, and this can range from what we call monoclonal antibodies. These are proteins that preferentially find and stick to the tumor cells and kill them by different mechanisms, or small molecules, which also preferentially favor killing the tumor cells while sparing the normal cells. And these small molecules can be given either in the vein or sometimes by oral pills. There's different, as I said, drugs that are available for clinical trials, and I would encourage patients who are eligible for these trials to try them, because the side effects profile for these novel agents is completely different from chemotherapy, and patients can frequently tolerate these treatments for extended period of times compared to combination chemotherapeutic regimens. My personal preference is to use the combination chemotherapy when patients have bulky relapse disease, symptomatic, that requires quick response, cytoreduction or response. Patients who have a small volume disease, small lymph nodes here and there, with not much of symptoms, my personal approach is to offer them these relatively non-toxic treatment regimens or investigational drugs, while keeping the chemotherapeutic regimens for more bulky, symptomatic patients. By doing so, the tolerance and toxicity profiles can range from standard side effects from chemotherapy, the hair loss, nausea, vomiting, drop in the blood cell counts, possible infections, transfusions, requirement for antibiotics, fatigue and tiredness, and so forth. Whereas some of these novel agents, the toxic effects are less, and some of them have also cytopenia or fatigue, but frequently they don't have the hair loss, they don't have the nausea and vomiting, they don't have the requirement for transfusions in the majority of the cases. And I will stop here and keep the future open for any questions from the audience later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yunez, again, for an excellent presentation and very clearly spoken, and actually providing really a nice framework for people in terms of the treatment options and the care that would be available in terms of treatment for relapsed refractory disease. Thank you very much, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Our third speaker is Dr. Strauss, and actually Dr. David Strauss is attending physician Lymphoma Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's also professor of clinical medicine, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Strauss is going to address issues around survivorship, long-term survivorship from Hodgkin lymphoma, and he's also going to address communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Strauss?
Thank you very much. Again, I would also like to thank Dr. Meissner and Cancer Care for inviting me to speak to you today. I would like to speak about follow-up. As Dr. Connors indicated and Dr. Yunus, we have very long-term remissions and probably cures in the majority of patients treated with Hodgkin lymphoma. And so the question is how to follow them. The following first treatment, probably the greatest period of risk for recurrence is the first 3 years. So follow-up 3 to 5 years, really particularly 3 years, but maybe out to 5 years. So for the first 5 years, the frequency of follow-up is kind of reflects this period of risk for recurrence. And there are different places do it differently, but kind of the policy we have done here at Memorial Sloan Kettering is to follow patients every 3 months for the first year after treatment, every 4 months for the second and third year, every 6 months for years 4 and 5, and then annually after 5 years. During the period, the first 5 years, the follow-up is really directed at mostly at looking, checking and looking for recurrence. One side effect occurs relatively early on, and that is in patients who get radiation therapy to the neck, a third to a half of them will develop sort of a low thyroid condition that may require replacement with thyroid medication. We also follow blood counts. We follow x-rays, chest x-rays, and CAT scans. Often we will alternate them on alternate visits. After 5 years, the recurrence likelihood drops, and we then are really concerned about problems of survivorship and late toxicities related to treatment. Many of these late toxicities are related to radiation therapy, so that a lot of the screening and kind of things that we've learned about survivors really pertain to radiation therapy. As Dr. Connors indicated, we still use radiation therapy. It is a very useful tool and a very effective treatment, but because of these long side effects, we have been somewhat limiting its use more than we did in the past. There is sort of an emerging amount of information about survivors. The pediatricians really have pioneered this more than adult oncologists. There is a very large trial, a survivorship study called the Children's Cancer Survivor Study, which has looked at approximately 10,000 adult survivors of childhood cancer. Among these, Hodgkin lymphoma accounted for between 1,800 and 1,900 patients. They looked at, sent questionnaires to these survivors addressing their overall health status, and they compared them with their siblings. And they found a lot of chronic conditions and maladies in these survivors. There is emerging data, probably less data, for people who were treated in adulthood. We have been looking at our experience here at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and we have a database of 519 survivors who were treated on 6 different clinical trials here, most of which were combinations of chemotherapy and radiation therapy between 1975 and 2000. The patient's average age when they were treated was around 28 or 29, and the time that we obtained information from them was about 20 years later, so they were 48 or 49 at that time. Of these patients, we have been able to get information in self-reported questionnaires from approximately 240 patients. And we found, a fair number of late conditions. Second cancers is one of the major things we see, with an incidence of around 1% a year, so that at 25 years, maybe 25% or so of the long survivors may have a second cancer. In women, breast cancer is one of the more common ones. Sarcomas, thyroid cancer, lung cancer, particularly in smokers, and others are also seen. Most of these seem to be related to radiation therapy. And again, we're limiting its use, both omitting it in some patients and limiting the extent of it in the patients who do receive it. So we may not see the same thing. The other major group of things we see are things we sort of categorize as cardiovascular. These include narrowing of the carotid arteries in the neck, and there is an increased incidence of stroke, and early coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is a very common condition in adults anyway, but the risk of it is increased by treatment, particularly with radiation therapy. There are also more subtle muscle and electrical disorders in the heart. And scarring of the heart valves is another thing that is seen, sometimes requiring surgical replacement. There are other things seen as well. Sometimes skin cancers can be seen. Musculoskeletal problems, sometimes weakness in some muscles. So in the annual follow-up that we do of patients, and again, this is not really so standardized, it has been our policy to try to follow people annually really sort of forever, although I'm not sure that is necessarily standard of practice. I think certainly the pediatricians, once these people become adults, they go back to their primary care doctors. And some oncologists will discharge patients after a certain period of time for follow-up care with primary care physicians. I think the understanding of the problems of survivors is something that there is a tremendous, we really need to do a lot of education. But the things we look at in late follow-up is we certainly, in addition to looking for recurrence, which is relatively rare, we certainly carefully look at the thyroid gland. We palpate it. We listen for things in the neck that might indicate narrowing of the carotid arteries. We make sure people have had cardiovascular lipid testing, and I think that people who have had chest irradiation that we would recommend, and there are not formal guidelines for this, but some sort of screening, perhaps stress testing. Women should have annual breast imaging of some sort starting probably about 8 years or so, at least after treatment, or if they reach age 40 before this time, at that point. Mammograms have been the standard in the past. More recently, there's data to suggest that in young women where breast tissue is less dense, that MRI may be a somewhat better screening procedure. And in some patients, sonography with some type of breast anatomy sonography can be used. But again, attention to this annually. We have also found, interestingly, in this study that there is a fair number of patients with emotional problems in the survivor population. We found a somewhat higher incidence of depression and anxiety, sometimes requiring medication or some sort of supportive or psychotherapy. And we actually, something that was sort of alarming was that 12% of these patients were current smokers, which is a little bit higher than we would expect in patients this age. So I think that this, we are developing more objective criteria for follow-up based on studies such as ours, and I think in the future we will probably have more formal algorithms for this. So I think this actually brings us a little bit over the time allotted for speaking, so I'll stop here, and I think we probably should go ahead and get the question and answer period.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Strauss. Thank you, actually, for an excellent presentation. Also, for sharing with us your research, which is really quite important in terms of the research in this area that really I think you probably are the researcher in this area, so that's very helpful to hear what the research shows and things to be aware of. So I know there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. Before we take questions, I just want to introduce two other people who are going to say a few words of welcome. I want to introduce Kathy Brown, who's Director of Research at the Lymphoma Research Foundation, who's going to speak to you on behalf of the Lymphoma Research Foundation, who really has played a very critical role in really helping to plan and support and fund today's program. So, Kathy?
Hello. On behalf of the Lymphoma Research Foundation, I want to thank you, Cancer Care, for your commitment to quality educational programs. Through these collaborations, we're better able to serve. Dr. Connors, Eunice, and Strauss give tirelessly of their expertise and energy to educate patients, and we're fortunate to work with them. The Lymphoma Research Foundation, LRF, is the nation's largest lymphoma-focused voluntary health organization, devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing you critical information on the disease. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. To do so, LRF provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for patients, survivors, and loved ones. They include Lymphoma Helpline and Clinical Trials Information Service, where our trained staff can help you with lymphoma education and clinical trials. The Lymphoma Support Network, which is our buddy program, publications and newsletters, informational teleconferences and webcasts, and in-person conferences. We know that a lymphoma diagnosis can be very confusing and overwhelming, and that people are looking for information specifically focusing on their form of the disease. To help you, LRF offers Hodgkin's lymphoma specific resources, including fact sheets, webcasts, and podcasts. LRF will launch new Hodgkin resources next week for both the newly diagnosed and those with relapsed or refractory disease. Visit www.lymphoma.org/Hodgkin to access these. LRF is here to help lymphoma patients, survivors, and loved ones. For more information, please contact us at 800-500-9976 or visit our website at www.lymphoma.org. And thank you again.
Well, thank you very much, Kathy, for your very warm words of welcome to everybody and for also explaining to everybody all the resources at the Lymphoma Research Foundation, which is just such a wonderful resource for everybody on this call. And our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker, and he's program coordinator of blood cancers, project coordinated mind-body program at Cancer Care. And Rick is also going to tell you a bit about the service of Cancer Care, and I'm going to turn the program over to Rick.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, Drs. Strauss, Eunice, and Connors, for your thoughtful presentations, and Kathy Brown for giving such a nice oversight of Lymphoma Research Foundation. We collaborate on many things with them. Great organization as well. As Cancer Care's blood cancer program coordinator, I want to give you a brief introduction of what Cancer Care can offer you after this telephone education workshop. A cancer diagnosis often brings conflict and crisis to the life of a patient, as well as to those who care, love, and work with that person. At Cancer Care, we have over 40 master's degree social workers specializing in oncology who are here to help you resolve some of the conflicts you might be struggling with and ultimately find some level of peace. Now, this can be emotional peace through one of our many professionally facilitated telephone, online, and face-to-face groups, or in a counseling intervention with one of our social workers. peace might be some respite from financial concerns through one of our financial grants. Or perhaps you can gain knowledge and peace of mind through one of our educational workshops like today, or guidance on how to navigate the complicated world of cancer treatment and recovery through better healthcare communication, understanding insurance claims, or additional community-based resources that you weren't aware of. Tips that can guide you along this process: do your research. The Internet is a good place to start, but there are also many helpful organizations, such as Cancer Care, that can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will go a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. 2, take your time. Saying, "I need a day to think about this," can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones and from other resources. And 3, speak up. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. At Cancer Care, we can't promise to solve all of the concerns that may arise out of a cancer diagnosis and treatment, but with over 60 years in the ever-changing field of oncology, we are dedicated to trying one patient and one family at a time. You can reach us at www.cancercare.org or at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for that wonderful description of Cancer Care services, and certainly we invite people to take advantage of these services. They are free and available to all of you, and the same is true for the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, so I'm going to ask Mary to bring on all of our speakers, and we are going to actually start taking questions. Mary, if you would explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Elizabeth.
Hi. I just got diagnosed on Friday, and one question I have is if Dr. Connors or anybody else can discuss the pros and cons of the ABVD treatment versus the Stanford 5 treatment.
Thank you for the excellent question, Elizabeth. And Dr. Connors, could you address that?
Okay. Well, what the caller is asking about is different ways for the chemotherapy drugs to be given. The ABVD combination was designed in the 1970s and has stood the test of time and emerged as what is mostly considered the gold standard of treatment when chemotherapy is to be used for Hodgkin lymphoma, at least in North America. It consists of drugs that are given by injection once every 2 weeks, and two of those together is called a cycle. Typically, patients receive 3 to 6 cycles, depending on their stage, as I explained earlier. Stanford 5 is a different way of putting a similar list of the drugs. There are one or two additional drugs added in the Stanford 5 recipe, but the biggest difference is that the chemotherapy is given once each week for 12 weeks. Stanford 5 is ordinarily planned to be combined with radiation treatment, so it should be viewed as part of a package, that is, the chemotherapy for 12 weeks and then the radiation treatment to follow that for most patients. The final choice between these two recipes really needs to be individualized for a particular patient, because recent studies have shown that each of the two programs works equally well. Neither is superior to the other in terms of controlling the Hodgkin lymphoma, but each performs very well and according to our best standards. And that means that the final choice and the final recommendation to a patient is going to have to be made by the actual team of doctors that are assessing that individual patient to decide whether the emphasis should be on a briefer course of treatment, as in the Stanford 5 recipe, or the more standard ABVD recipe.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Evelyn.
Hi. I have a question, and I don't know if maybe it was addressed if I did move signal for a moment, but stem cell transplant with Hodgkin's disease, and what is the standard of treatment once the patient has had a stem cell transplant and the Hodgkin's reappears?
Excellent question. Thank you very much, Evelyn. And Dr. Yunes, could you address that question?
Sure. Excellent question. So, as I indicated earlier, stem cell transplant in best-case scenario works for patients who achieve second complete remission immediately before going into the high-dose therapy in stem cell transplant. And in the best-case scenario, stem cell transplant is expected to cure approximately 50% of the patients. That leaves another 50% who would require additional therapy after transplant. And so at the present time, there's no standard approach. The good news is that there are multiple choices, that each one of them could be a good choice depending on the patient clinical presentations, availabilities, tolerance, and also preference. So there are multiple choices available, including chemotherapy, and, as I said, investigational, potentially less toxic treatments, including what we call targeted therapy, monoclonal antibodies, and small molecules. So short answer, there is no standard of care, but there are multiple options available that can potentially prolong patient survival.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Cheryl.
Thanks for taking my question. I'm actually a 27-year survivor of Hodgkin lymphoma, so certainly addressing more of the survivor issues. I'm especially interested in reproductive issues and issues related to offspring, and wondering if there's been any long-term follow-up looking at that particular issue.
Thank you for the question. Dr. Strauss, could you address that?
Sure. Reproductive compromise is really a problem of treatment. I would say that some of the more recent regimens, particularly ABVD, seem to be associated with less incidence of infertility than some of the regimens we used in the past. In particular, female fertility, it's been shown recently, is really pretty well preserved, not so affected by the drugs in the ABVD regimen. Less data, really, for males. If fertility is an issue for females, I guess there are assisted reproductive measures that can be taken. The really standard would be embryo cryopreservation, and more experimental would be egg cryopreservation or ovarian tissue preservation. For men, if fertility is an issue, we recommend sperm banking. For people who are not infertile and are able to have children, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that there is an increased risk of a miscarriage or an abnormal child for people who are able to have children following treatment as compared to sort of the normal population. And Hodgkin lymphoma is an acquired disease. It is not an inherited disease. That being said, there are families where more than one family member may have Hodgkin lymphoma, and it's possible in those families there may be some kind of genetic precondition that sort of predisposes to or increases the risk for this. And there are examples of this in other cancers such as colon cancer and breast cancer. Subpopulations of the large number of patients with these diseases have genes that make them more prone to get it than the normal population. For Hodgkin lymphoma, as I said, there are families that where multiple members, where one or more member may have Hodgkin lymphoma, and there may be such factors in those families, although no genes to date have been identified. But in general, this is an acquired disease, there may be unusual there may be a minority of patients where there may be a predisposition in some families. I'm not sure if that is answers your question.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Strauss, for addressing that excellently. And I also Evelyn would certainly want to invite you to certainly contact, Cheryl, actually, to contact the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care for our staff to be able to speak with you in more in depth about this issue as well. And I will certainly call you after the call as well. That's an excellent question. I think it's a question that probably many people on the call have concerns about. So I want to thank you, Cheryl, for actually for that question. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Maria.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was diagnosed with nodular mantle cell lymphoma and received R-CHOP 6 cycles. I am now in remission and starting rituximab every 3 months. And I was just wondering if there are any new chemos for mantle cell on the horizon.
Excellent question. Dr. Connors, can you address that?
Okay, we're moving a little bit afield. So this is a different kind of disease, mantle cell lymphoma, one of the non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And the treatment that the caller has described of multi-drug chemotherapy, then followed by occasional doses of rituximab to try to maintain a remission, is one of the standard treatments that's used around the world. The question was about new treatments for mantle cell lymphoma, and there, fortunately, newer drugs are being found to be effective in this particular type of lymphoma than we had available only a short time ago. These are being brought onto the market, or they are emerging through clinical trial investigations, and I think expand the possible treatments that we can use should the mantle cell lymphoma come back again. But it is a little bit afield from the topic of Hodgkin lymphoma, so I think I better encourage the caller to take advantage of some of the resources that we did hear about earlier in the program and pursue her questions further.
And so, Muriel, we would encourage you then to actually contact the Lymphoma Research Foundation for more information about mantle cell lymphoma, the National Cancer Institute, Cancer Care, and all the other organizations. We have done some specific telephone education workshops on mantle cell lymphoma. They are available on telephone replay as well as podcasts. So I hope that's helpful to you as well. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Tonu.
Yes, my question would be following up after remission. Are we increasing our problems such as second cancers with all of the CTs, MRIs, and whatnot that are done with radiation, like X-ray radiation and the contrast? And the other question I have would be, if you've now become allergic to the iodine contrast, what would be a good follow-up scan later on down the road for checking for remission?
Excellent questions. Dr. Strauss, can you address that?
Yes, sure. There is some data now in very large populations suggesting that radiation from X-rays such as CAT scans, which is a kind of X-ray, may slightly increase the risk of second cancers. I wouldn't say that in clinical practice this has been observed very obviously to be a problem. Certainly, second cancers related to therapeutic doses of radiation is a definite problem and is something we really can identify. I guess in the future we may somewhat reduce the amount of X-ray imaging that we do in follow-up because of these concerns, but we have really not hesitated to use CT scans or chest X-rays if we feel that they're helpful in either following for relapse or for other problems related to treatment. Regarding intravenous contrast allergy, technically probably the best quality CT scans that are the best, that are the easiest to interpret and give us the best pictures are done with IV contrast. However, if we have to omit it, we can live without it. I mean, the CT scans that are done without IV contrast are also quite good, maybe not quite as good as those done with IV contrast, so that if we can't use it, we just omit it. And I don't think that's a major problem if we have to do that.
Thank you, Dr. Strauss. I think I hear a collective sigh of relief because I know that there are many people who for whom that is an issue. So thank you for addressing those issues so well. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Dorothy.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Mine's kind of twofold for long term. I'm 14 years out from Hodgkin stage 4. And does the limited radiation therapy like mini-mantle field still increase the risk of CAD? And secondary, since I've had problems with anemia from the get-go, my blood counts dropped to 9-10, and could that be from the bone marrow suppression? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dorothy, for those questions. Dr. Strauss, would you be able to address these?
Okay. First, limited radiation therapy involved field as compared to the more extensive radiation therapy fields that we used in the past. It certainly may be that reducing the size of the fields will decrease the risk of heart disease and cardiovascular disease. However, there is some troubling data suggesting that even with limited radiation therapy, as we did in the past, that we still may be seeing some of this. Now, I will say that the involved fields and the size of the fields have decreased with time, so that currently often the size of the fields is even smaller than we used in the past when we used involved field and limited radiation therapy. So maybe that will be further reduced. But there is sort of an intrinsic problem to radiation. And I guess, you know, I mean, it's really the areas involved are really the areas that, you know, the normal tissues are really at risk. Again, possibly with reduced fields we may be seeing less, but I don't know that we really know that for sure as yet. The second part of the question was about
Her anemia.
Anemia. Yeah, I mean, this is not the usual late complication of treatment. Some of the chemotherapy regimens that we use more commonly in the past could have effects on the production of blood in the bone marrow, sort of the factory for blood. And sometimes we've seen anemias that are related to this kind of damage to the bone marrow. Again, ABVD and similar regimens seem to cause this less frequently. And rarely people can have immune anemias, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, anemias due to an immune problem. There are immune abnormalities in Hodgkin lymphoma, as Dr. Connors alluded to, and there's sort of sometimes abnormal immunity, and sometimes rarely there can be an immune reaction against the red blood cells that cause them to break up. That's a rare complication, but that can be another cause of anemia. I wouldn't say that anemia is one of the common late side effects that we usually see.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Susan.
Yes, thank you. I'm 27 years out from fourth stage Hodgkin's.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I was recently tested positive. Actually, I tend to test positive for TB, but there's no infection. Do you recommend that with my, you know, I had MOP, 8 months of MOP. Do you recommend I go on the drug treatment for latent TB?
Dr. Connors, can you address that?
Okay, so this is a fairly specific question about TB. A couple of parts to comment on. First of all, with 27 years between the time when the chemotherapy was given and now, I think that there's very little likelihood that there's any carryover effect from that. So I would tend to view this as an independent problem right now. Now, that said, it is on the background of you ever having had Hodgkin lymphoma, and it is true that people that have had Hodgkin lymphoma have some subtle changes, very minimal changes in the way their immune system works, And so it is best for them to take some extra precautions, like keeping all of their normal immunizations up to date and making sure that they've taken any other precautions to reduce any problems from infections recurring. But to come back specifically to this question, the final decision about using treatment for latent tuberculosis rests on an assessment of a number of factors that we really can't go into, such as how well all of your organs are working, especially your liver, whether you've had any problems with any kind of medications in the past, whether there's any sign that the tuberculosis, the TB, is active in any way right now. So I best caution you to discuss this in detail with the tuberculosis expert that will be advising you about whether you should take the prophylactic treatment or not.
And actually what Dr. Connors is really addressing is the concept, I believe, of the differential diagnosis. How does a doctor determine what's going on? I'm going to, as our concluding question, if I might ask all of you to just comment on just the, this raises a bigger issue of the issue of just how does one, the art and the science of medicine and in this area. So if all of our medical speakers would want to address this question just briefly before we conclude the call.
Do you want to choose one of us to go first?
Dr. Connors?
Okay. Well, I think I think what you're alluding to is that as much as we have in the way of solid information from clinical trials and from published information in the medical literature, ultimately there is an individualization and a fine-tuning of treatments, advice, and counseling that needs to be offered to each individual patient. And this can really only be accomplished by the specialist who actually fully assesses the Hodgkin lymphoma and the background in which it's taking place, all of the person's past medical history and any other problems they might have. And that specialist needs then to work with the patient's family physician, other specialists that may have been involved, and help to guide the crafting of a combined approach by all of those doctors working together. And that constitutes some science, but also some definite art in figuring out the best way to bring these recommendations to the patient's care. I'll stop there and see if there's some comments from the other speakers.
Thank you very much, Dr. Connors. Dr. Yunus, Dr. Strauss?
I would agree with that, absolutely. I think that every patient is different, and you can get. I think information in general terms is very, very useful, and there are many sources for this. But actually, when it comes to how your own particular situation it would be best managed, this really requires working with the doctor, for the doctor to really know all the details, to do a full history examination, and know all of the parameters. So that I think that it is a mistake to try to see something on the internet or in a pamphlet and say, well, I should do this based on this information, because it really, for your own particular situation, really, you should really have everything together, and it should be done really sort of one-to-one with your doctor.
Excellent. Dr. Yunus?
I agree with both Dr. Connors and Strauss. I just like to add that at the present time, especially when we talk about management of relapsed patients, it's really mainly art, and there is some science behind it also too, of course. But in the future, I think it's going to be a lot of science and little art, because that's the future of what we call personalized cancer therapy, where we would know in advance which patient would benefit from which treatment and recommend that to them in the future. But as of now, there's options, and it should be tailored based on mutual discussions and agreement between the patient and their physician.
Well, this is an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of our wonderful speakers today, and this has been an extraordinary presentations and discussion, wonderful questions from our audience, and wonderful people listening as well. And I want to thank everybody for for being on this call today. I want to remind everybody this is a one-hour education program, and that in that respect, of course, although we are going to be coming to close in a few minutes, we recognize in planning a program like this that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour program. And those are, in many of your questions, we could answer parts of them, but there are other parts that really we want to have more dialogue with you about. So you can see that there's a need for ongoing help. And that ongoing help does continue when the program ends. And that's what I really want to stress to all of you. Cancer Care, the Lymphoma Research Foundation, all the other organizations, we are with you every step of the way. And I want to just review again with you the services that you can access from both Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. We have staff of social workers who can assist you with your concerns and questions. We can help you with practical and financial matters. We can give you publications and fact sheets, and we can talk with you and provide you with information, really have a dialogue with you about your concerns, spend time with you on the phone or online about your concerns and questions. Perhaps most importantly, as we conclude today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with Hodgkin lymphoma, with cancer. I would not want you to feel that you're alone at all. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are truly with you every step of the way and that we are simply a phone call or a mouse click away. You can visit our websites or come and call us, and we are here to help you. I want to thank you all for participating in this extraordinary call today. I want to thank you again, and I want to invite you to contact us. All of our staffs are waiting to speak with you, and I look very much forward to hearing from all of you. And thank you all, and have a great day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect, and have a wonderful day.